Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, back on the air this week. It's a beautiful rainy morning in downtown Bushwick, but I'm here with my favorite co-host this morning, Carol Butler. And Carol, what's happening in the book world? I know you're working on a few projects.
I am. I'm very pleased. We just got the cover of the Bee book on Friday, and it looks beautiful, and it means that the book is almost printed. And the Bee book should be out. This is Why Do Bees Buzz, which will be out in February. And then the Do Hummingbirds Hum book is coming out in March. So there's a lot going on.
Sounds terrific. And I know you showed me a copy of the cover. It really looks very nice.
Thank you.
So to get onto our present show this morning, we're going to be talking about different sexual strategies and related topics. And before we get started, I want to mention we have a sponsor this morning, which is Whole Foods Markets, and that's a new sponsor, and I'm sure everybody knows about their terrific stores, probably all over the country by now. So the first critter I'm going to talk about this morning, and by the way, if you get a chance after the show to go on the gallery, which is our picture gallery, you'll see a picture of this, quote, beautiful fish. These fishes, I'm sure, are only beautiful to their mothers because they are one of the most awesome-looking fishes that there are. And it's called the anglerfish. And they're called the anglerfish because of their mode of predation. That means how they get their food. And what they do, what they have, is a protrusion from the top of their heads. First of all, these anglerfishes, there are many of them, many different species. But the one I'm going to talk about lives at the bottom of the deep seas, the zone where there's no light, the aphotic zone, which means the light never penetrates down here, about 3,000 feet down near the bottom. So it's perpetual darkness. So they have to find strategies to get food and also to find the mate. So, Carol, you know, how would they find the mate? They could use a flashlight down there.
Right, that's what they need.
Or something. Or some kind
or
of...
Or odors.
Yeah, odors, right. That's perfect, right. So they're named for their method of predation, as I said, and they're called an anglerfish, which is another word for fishing. So what they... Some of them have developed an actual lure. They have these protrusions, like the spines coming... The dorsal fin elongates, and growing out in front of their face, is some of them have a lure that looks like a worm. And they can wiggle this worm to make it look real.
Does it also glow?
Not the worm. The worm is just movement.
Okay.
I couldn't check to see if it really glowed. But it's movement in the water. And, you know, fishes can detect movement in the water. So that's the way they... one method of attracting a mate. And their mouth, which is a very interesting mouth, because their jaws, actually, they can open their mouth wide enough to swallow prey whole. And lining their mouth, they have these needle-sharp teeth that are pointing inward like a snake's fangs. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they have developed this, first why they developed this very wide mouth, which goes around from the front of their head all the way to the sides of their head, is because they can capture prey whole and just swallow it down. And the needle-sharp teeth help them ensure that they can capture the prey. They only get one shot at it. And the needle teeth capture the prey, and since they point inward, the fish can pass the prey that they have captured right down into their throats.
I picture it like a Muppet with teeth, right?
Yes, it's really a huge mouth, and these teeth are needle sharp. So I suggest you folks go look at the picture of these predators on the gallery. Well, the one I'm going to talk about doesn't have a worm. But it has what it's called an esca, which is an organ on top of its head, like at the end of a fishing pole, that what glows in the dark.
That's what I was thinking.
Yes,
about,
glows in the dark. And the way it works is there are bacteria that find their way into this thing. It's like a globe. It's like a light with a globe over it. The bacteria find their way into this esca, and they spend their lives in there. Hmm. And when they reproduce to a physician, you know, a large amount, the light really glows. So the anglerfish uses this glowing lure to attract predators, prey. And it seems to work very well because here they are living down where it's very deep and dark, and individuals are few and far between. So also they have to find a mate in this perpetual darkness. So an interesting thing happens living in this aphotic zone, which I said it's always dark. Okay, so they use the light to capture food. And what about finding a mate? Well, what happens is they have to give off a pheromone, which is a scent. And you know, scents are carried very well in the water as well as right. in the air. And they give off this pheromone, and they attract a mate. So we've been talking mostly about the female anglerfish, which is probably about 12 to 14 inches long in some species. So it's a good-sized fish. Okay, now the male anglerfish is a whole nother story. When the male anglerfish is born, you know, the eggs, the females lay fertilized eggs, and you know the life cycle. They emerge from the egg as a larva, and they swim around, and they start to develop. But the male is tiny compared to the female. The male could be about maybe an inch long, and the female is about 12 inches long. So she's huge in relation to the male. So what happens is, as the male matures, what happens to his digestive system is the male can eat when he's a young baby because, first of all, he has the yolk sac from the egg to feed on, and then he can eat plankton. But as he matures, his digestive system deteriorates. Got that? Making him incapable of feeding on his own. So he must quickly find a female. Okay? So he has a very, very the male has a very, very sensitive olfactory apparatus, which means a nose.
Sounds like he needs it.
Yeah, which he can smell things.
Right.
And you know, in the water, the scents are in the water, so they're carried by the currents and all that. So the male, since he has a very sensitive olfactory organ, can detect the female scent. Okay, so it signals that there's a female nearby. Okay, and here's what happens when he finds her. He bites into her skin and releases an enzyme that digests the skin of his mouth and her body. Got that picture?
I'm trying to picture.
Okay.
It.
Fusing the pair together.
Ah, okay.
Down to the blood vessel level. Okay? So he does this right near her reproductive opening to her body. So here's this little tiny fish with really sharp needle teeth, the male, bites into the female right near her reproductive organ, and his skin dissolves and her skin dissolves, and after a day or two, he's actually becomes part of her body.
Right, the two are one.
The two are one, and that's what you call mating for life.
Right.
Now, that's real monogamy.
That's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, so it's similar to a fetus being nourished by the blood vessels in the placenta. That's how a baby in the placenta, the baby doesn't bite it, but the umbilical cord is attached to the developing
they have fetus, a shared circulatory system.
They have a
system.
Shared circulatory yeah. system. Right. So anything that's in the mother's blood supply circulates into the baby's blood supply, and in this case, into the male fish. So he doesn't have to worry about feeding himself anymore. And the male then atrophies into nothing more than a pair of gonads. So he, or his gonads, as he is now reduced to his basics, whenever a hormone, if the female has a hormone in the blood supply, okay, that will signal, I hate to call him a male now.
Well, let's call him his gonads.
Right? Yes, Mr. Gonads. Right. Yes, Mr. Balls. Okay, so what happens is he will, it will release sperm.
Or they will, right.
Yeah, at her genital opening.
Right.
So the eggs can become fertilized. So this is as an example of extreme sexual dimorphism. And dimorphism means that the male and female do not look the same.
Right.
So many critters have that. You know, the colors of some birds, the males are much more colorful than females. That's dimorphism. So that's a really interesting strategy. But remember what we're talking about, a fish that lives in perpetual darkness down at the bottom of the seas. And when I always tell this to women, they really chuckle about this because there's a ready supply of sperm whenever the female needs it.
Right.
And she doesn't have to go through the hassle of, you know, in our culture, all kinds of hassles,
right,
and machinations and all that. So I thought that was an interesting thing to start off today's program with. Okay? And we also eat one of the relatives of this fish. It's called the goosefish, or the common name for it is the
monkfish.
The monkfish, right, which is absolutely delicious, and the meat is like lobster. So that's the first part of our program for today. Remember, this is The Naturalist, and my special guest today is Carol Butler, the author, and we'll be back in a minute. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, back on the public radio. I almost said public radio. Okay, the Heritage Radio Network. And our sponsor today is Whole Foods Markets, which you know and I know is a huge place for buying foods, and almost everything you could want in the way of foods are in that place. So the next critter I'm going to talk about, that first one I spoke about on the first part, the anglerfish. I just wanted to add one little thing about it, was that when people started doing research on this fish, they were only catching what they thought were females. And they said, where are the males? Where are the males to this species? And they noticed some little pieces of flesh hanging down near her reproductive organ, and they thought they were parasites, because fishes are sometimes played with parasites, like most critters are. But then they realized that those were the males. So I thought that was really an interesting story. So I'm going to tell another story now. I wonder how many of you remember the movie Nemo, which came out, I don't know how many years ago. Carol, what do you think, about 8-9 years ago, Nemo? Or
I don't know if it was quite that long, but several years ago.
Several years ago, and all the kids had to go see it.
Wonderful movie.
And it was a good movie for kids because it was pretty educational about the lifestyles of a lot of sea creatures, and they were fairly accurate in their portrayal of them. But the problem was that I think it was made by Disney, this movie, and it was aimed at kids because the real story about Nemo wouldn't have been the story in the movie. But basically, as I remember, Nemo's mother gets eaten by a shark or something.
Right.
And then Nemo takes off looking for his mother. He's hoping he can find his mother. And his father goes looking for Nemo. And I think that's the basic story of the whole movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So in real life, this it's called a clown anemone fish. These fishes live in a relationship with an anemone. An anemone is related to a jellyfish. They have stinging cells, and they're sessile. That means they can't move. So what happens is that the clown anemone fish will move in and live amongst the tentacles of the anemone. Now, you remember that the anemone is poisonous. It has these poisonous darts that it gives off in its nematocytes. But so how come the fish doesn't really get bothered by this? Is, well, there are a couple of theories. One theory is that the clownfish secretes a jelly-like substance on its body, which makes it immune to the stinging of the anemone fish.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
So that's the story. So remember, we're talking about Nemo now, the story of Nemo. So what happens is that the fish and the anemone form a lifelong relationship. Okay, you get an anemone family consisting of a male, a female, and their offspring, and some other males that are prepubescent males, and they're just hanging around. So what's the relationship? It's a sort of a symbiotic relationship, because the anemone protects the clownfish, which is a small little fish. It's about 3 inches long, and the anemone keeps the predators away from this small fish, because they're all afraid of the anemone, because it's poison tentacles and it's very deadly poison. And what does the anemone fish do for the anemone? Well, what the anemone fish does, he keeps the anemone clean.
Oh, right.
Okay. So if there's debris or particles of something in the water, the anemone fish will pick them off and eat them. If they're edible. If they're not edible, he'll pick them off and get rid of them. So they have this great relationship where the clownfish is the caretaker of the anemone.
Right.
And the anemone is the protector of the clownfish. Right. So it seems to work out pretty well. Now, in the movie, as you recall, Nemo's mother got killed. So here's Nemo without a mother and just a father. So Nemo leaves his anemone, which in nature it would never happen, and goes looking for his mother. And his father leaves the anemone, going looking for Nemo. So here's this anemone left without its protector, which wouldn't happen either, because it's a lifelong relationship. So what would really happen would be this, okay? As soon as his mother was killed, eaten by this shark, I guess it was in the movie, the dominant female in this group arrangement, which would be his mother, would turn into...
Well, his mother was eaten.
Oh, yeah, his mother, sorry. That's a good correction. I'm getting my fishes mixed up.
Right.
Okay, so his father wouldn't go running off, but his father would slowly turn into a female.
Right.
So picture this. His father would now be his mother.
Right.
So I don't know what we should call this relationship, but... it's an example of homomorphism, I always have trouble with that word, where first the fish is male, and then they turn into female. So that's fairly common in the world of fishes.
A lot of fishes
can do that. Cichlids can change their sex, which is a whole category of fish that live in freshwater, and all that. So I don't think Disney wanted to make the movie to show that, because it's... interesting sexual variation that we never think about. I mean, we know about human hermaphrodites, which I don't know much about, and other critters that change their sex.
Well, humans change their gender or make an attempt to change their gender.
Right, and sometimes successfully,
But
they have to have surgery if they have both organs in their body, right?
Well, it's more complex than that these days.
It's more complex because of culture
and
all that.
Right.
But... with fish, nobody asks questions.
Right.
They do what comes naturally. So that was another interesting strategy. And I'll just go over some theories about how the anemone fish protects itself from this anemone. First of all, I said it has a mucus coating on its body. But the mucus coating, just being mucus, wouldn't mean much to the anemone. If the anemone could sense a nice protein meal, he would certainly sting the fish and try to digest it. Oh, that's another thing, that in experiments with these anemones and the anemone fish, they took and fed, this was in an aquarium that some scientists were running this project on, and they took and fed some small goldfish to the anemone fish.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they broke it up into pieces for him. And the anemone fish couldn't eat it because they have a very small mouth. Their mouth is designed to eat plankton, which are these little zooplankton, tiny little critters that are, you know, very small size of a pinhead. That's what they live on, or detritus in the water, which is just nutrients that are in the water. So the anemone fish took these pieces of goldfish and put it on the anemone. And the anemone was able to digest.
And break it down so that the clownfish could eat it, probably.
Yeah, but it ended up as food for the anemone. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question about the slime on the anemone fish, protecting it, is true. But they found out that the chemical basis of the slime wasn't a protein basis, that it's based on some kind of a sugar.
Right, makes sense.
So the sugar is not attractive to the anemone. It's not sugar like we use table sugar, but it's a sugar-based
compound.
Right. Mm. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Okay, and so you have to look at this as co-evolution of certain species of clownfish and specific anemone host.
Right.
So there's a lot of examples of this in nature.
We see that with pollinators, right?
Right.
That certain plants evolve to fit certain pollinators, and as time passes, they grow so that they're a perfect fit.
Right.
The bat's mouth grows to the shape of the particular pollen flower on a cactus, for example. And there are a lot of examples like that.
Yeah, so scientists conclude that this slime that they develop is specifically for the anemone,
right?
Because they don't detect it as food. Okay, so there's a case of I don't know what we should call it. If we should call it mutualism or symbiotic relationship.
Right. Well, that's what we were talking before the program about, the difference between mutualism and symbiosis. It's a delicate kind of difference.
It is, because some people use it one way and some people use it the other way. So we'll call it a symbiotic relationship, even though it's between two different species. A lot of times mutualism, I think, is interspecies of in the same species, Carol?
Mutualism is two different species.
Two different species.
That have adapted to work together.
Okay, so this would be mutualism.
This is, right.
So I think what we read before the program, they said symbiotic behavior, and then they said mutualism as one variation of symbiotic behavior. So here's another strategy for survival. These fishes live on reefs, and it's the first fish that has been able to be raised in captivity for the whole life cycle, is the clown anemone fish. Mm. So you see them in many, many, many aquariums, usually in tanks that are bigger than 20 gallons, because it's a saltwater fish, and saltwater aquariums are more difficult than freshwater to maintain. But they've been successful in it, and they even try to get an anemone. If they don't get an anemone for this fish to guard, then they have to get something else.
Right, and in Nemo, the baby ends up in a fish tank, and there's an anemone.
That's right. I forgot that part. Yeah. That's good, right? The offspring ends up in a tank. So that's another strategy for survival, and even though we're calling this a lot about sexual behavior and things like that, it's actually a survival technique that this pair, I should say, have developed. So that's my second part of the show today, the anemone clownfish, and that's what it's called because of the anemone that it lives with. So this is The Naturalist. We're going to sign off for a minute, and then we'll come back with one more segment in this. And then Carol Butler is going to do the next show, which will be on the following week, about other strategies. And I think she's going to talk about some other organisms.
Right, sexual conflicts.
Sexual conflicts, which we haven't spoken about
yet. So far, these are not conflicts.
No, these are not conflicts yet.
Right.
But that's her business.
Right.
Carol's business is sexual conflicts.
That's right.
Okay. Hi, this is Bernie Wise back on the air, and I'm going to talk about one more critter, an ocean critter, but not a fish. I'm going to talk about a shellfish. And you know that shellfishes are mollusks. I always have trouble with that word. And this is like a snail. So snails are called gastropods. So they're a kind of mollusk, but they only have one shell. And they're called the word gastropod means walking on your stomach, believe it or not. But I'm not going to talk about that today. But so shellfish, and these are snails. And the one I'm going to talk about is called, it has a lot of common names, a slipper shell, or a boat shell, or a quarterdeck shell. It depends on where you live, what they're called. But if you've walked along beaches and you find an empty shell, and it has a little deck on the inside of it.
It looks like a little rowboat.
A little rowboat, yeah, with a deck, or like a slipper. Mm-hmm. So they're called slipper shells, or like, they're really like limpets, because they spend their whole life attached to rocks and they really don't go anywhere. So I'm going to talk a bit about this one, and the scientific name of this one is very interesting. And I'll just mention the name, and then we'll talk about at the end of the show the derivation of this name. It's called Crepidula fornicata. Now that word fornicata is a very interesting word, but we'll hold that till the end of the show.
The suspense is going to kill me.
The suspense, right. So they're about an inch and a half in size, and I just described them. And what they do is, after their larval free-swimming stages, they attach themselves. They like to live communally and together. So they could attach themselves to other shells or oysters. They're really a pain in the neck, I should say that, for oysters, because some oysters are called great neck oysters and... pain in the neck. Well, okay. So, and sometimes they attach themselves to horseshoe crabs. So if you see a horseshoe crab around with a shell attached to it, it's probably a Crepidula fornicata. And they go for a ride with the horseshoe crab, and it seems to be a good arrangement. Okay? Except that their lifestyle is this. They are what is known as a protandrous hermaphrodite. I have trouble with that word. I have to practice it.
Hermaphrodite.
Good. Okay. Thanks, Carol. Okay. Which means that the animal starts its life as a male and subsequently will change its sex and develop into a female. Okay. So I'm going to read to you from one of my favorite books. It's called The Sensuous Seas, Tales of a Marine Biologist by Gene Kaplan, who is a fairly famous marine biologist. And he put out a guide to... Tropical Seashores and Caribbean Beaches. That's a terrific book. If you're going to go traveling to that part of the world and you want to take along a book, he did a great job on it. And, you know, it's in the Peterson Field Guide series, because Roger Peterson was a famous bird guy, and he's put out the first field guide, and now there's a whole library shelf full of these field guides. And Gene Kaplan did the one on the seas. So I'm going to... read something from the book, because he puts it so beautifully, and he's a good writer, and I'm not a good writer. So I have to find the right page first, and here it is. Okay, the common slipper shell, as we said, is called Crepidula fornicata, because one finds them piled up one on another. So what happens is, as if they were fornicating, 4 to 8 in a reproducing clump. By the way, if you want to see this sex in action, if you go to the photo gallery, I have a picture of about 6 or 7 of them stacked up one on top of each other. The topmost is a male, and the intermediates show development where more and more testicular tissue is becoming ovarian. So the top one is a male. That's the newest one in the stack. So what happens is they'll settle onto a female. If it's only 2 in the stack, if there are many in the stack already, the female, because remember they're all male when they're born, so this young female will set on top of a stack. So the small male, separated from the female by its intermediate cis brethren, as he calls it, cis-dash brethren, usually fertilizes the female by using a long penis. Which species, barnacle or slipper shell, sports the more developed endowed male? Which male is more endowed? Well, it's sort of a debate. In one of my first shows, I spoke about the barnacle, mm-hmm. which has to reach from his little volcano-shaped shell all the way over into the next one, which will be female. So he has a very long penis in relation to his size. And here we have another critter, the slipper shell, where the male has to be able to reach the female, the mature female, to impregnate her. Mm-hmm. So if the stack is very high, he has a tough job because the intermediate ones may not be female yet. They may be still changing into the female. Hmm. So it's a tough job. Okay.
So they're all impregnating the one on the bottom?
Yes, or if the females in the stack are already developed mature okay. females, he will impregnate the one right underneath them. This problem has never been resolved about the penis size. No researcher is willing to spend his days comparing the penis length of barnacles versus snails.
I'm surprised that they haven't.
Well, you know, they're waiting for a female to do it because, you know, they have a vested interest in that too, right? The important issue is that in two diverse phyla, that means branches of critters, arthropods, which are crabs and other crustaceans, and mollusks, which are snails, the huge penis has evolved to solve the problem of internal fertilization of attached organisms. So, because that's it's a difficult thing. If you can't really move
right.
to find your mate, you're in big trouble, okay? So, then he talks about evolution. It says perhaps, he says that perhaps that evolution is not directional. Structures and styles may be retained just because an alternative set of mutations has not arisen. Okay, because we know through evolution that mutations are a big factor in it to change the organisms mm-hmm. to make them survive better. If the mutation is detrimental, then that species will die out. If the mutation is beneficial, then it's retained. Okay, so he says that, so far, as we know, that the development of the penis has been the most efficient method of fertilizing another creature. It says this ancient solution to survival seems to be so effective that substantial morphological variations have not been selected for. Mm. So the point of this is that of this little talk is that first that the species changes its sex. Okay, so it's a hermaphrodite and a sequential hermaphrodite because it starts out as a male and they slowly evolve into female. So as I said, the newest male will settle on top of the stack and he's a fully developed male and his penis will become enlarged because of the pheromones from the females below him and then he will inseminate the closest female in the mm-hmm. stack. And this goes on and on and on. And I don't know if there's a limit to how many they can stack up, but the picture that I put on the gallery, there were about 7 or 8 of them. Yeah. And probably that's the maximum because I could see these stacks being knocked over or fallen over, except that they have a very powerful suction that they stick to each other.
Do all slipper shells, in this genera?
Yeah,
reproduce that way
yeah,
in this
they
genus.
All, they all do it.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So he says that that's very effective, and that that the penis seems to be the best way so far in evolution to solve this problem. Okay. So the name Crepidula fornicata. The word fornicata, which is what Linnaeus gave to this critter, because he saw them stacked up and fornicating or reproducing. Fornix is the Latin word for vault or arch. And fornix is closely related to fornication. It seems that the prostitutes in ancient Rome used to hang out under the arches of certain public buildings. The act of carrying on an illicit sexual relationship, consequently, came to be called going under the arches or fornication. Mm-hmm. So that's the origin of the word fornication. It has to do with an arch I thought it had to do with the shape of the slipper shell, which is an arch also, mm-hmm. but I looked it up. I couldn't find any reference to the shell. It's just their lifestyle of stacking up and fornicating. And so our English word, fornication, that's where it came from.
Interesting.
The prostitutes in Rome. Yeah. And I'm sure our word, the common word, fuck, came from the word fornication. And, of course, that word is used so much in our language. And I thought that was an interesting sidelight to this. And I'm trying to picture what went on in ancient Rome. All these prostitutes had this special place to hang out.
Right.
And in New York City, it used to be 8th Avenue and 42nd Street where they would hang out. I remember once driving in the middle of the night when I had to get to the tunnel, and there were all these women hanging around the curbs, you know, flashing. So you would open your car door and take them in for a little ride. But I never did that.
Good thing the segment is over, Bernie.
That's right, because we're getting personal, right? So remember about the word fornication, where it came from, and about this little snail called Crepidula fornicata. And that's the end of my program today. And remember that we're being sponsored by Whole Foods Markets. And remember my daughter's program called Why We Cook, which is on every week also. I think she records on Tuesdays. And I'm signing off with Carol Butler. And our next show will be on sexual conflicts. And Carol will... I'll be the one to ask her questions on that show.